thought I would speak about 20 or 30 minutes. I'd like to describe four lawsuits that are in various stages of litigation, tell you what you're likely to see coming out of the Supreme Court and ongoing litigation over the next couple of 3 years. But at the suggestion of a few people, I want to just start out by telling you how it is I got in this sort of sordid business of undivvying us up by race. And that particular phrase, some of you may recognize from Chief Justice John Roberts in a case that was decided a few years ago and that advanced the ball in ending race-based preferences in K through 12. He said, this is a sordid business, divvying us up by race. And indeed, it is a sordid business. My background is not in the law. I am not a lawyer. I am not a social scientist. Although I am a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and have been there now for almost 10 years, my story is a little unusual. I got into this simply out of a small miracle that took place in 1989, and that was my daughter was accepted to college. And my wife and I, at the time, were living in a garden variety Houston suburb. I was in the investment business. She was in the insurance business. And when our daughter left home, we decided we no longer really wanted to live in the suburbs. We wanted to live in kind of inner city Houston. I know David has spent some time in Houston. We wanted to move close to the museum district and near Rice University. I think it's a common pattern for professionals to want to leave the suburbs after the kids leave and move closer to sort of the downtown action. And we did that. Bought a house. And I went to vote for the first time in 1990 in my new neighborhood and looked at the ballot and realized that the Republican Party had not fielded a candidate to run against the incumbent Democrat. Now, I really wasn't a political animal, but that bothered me. That everyone should have a choice in virtually all of their candidate races. So I called the Republican Party of Houston, Harris County, and I was told, well, you know, you live in a primarily minority district, and, you know, Republicans just aren't going to win in a district like this. And that seemed like a reasonable explanation for someone who was in the investment business. But the more I thought about it, the more peeved I got. And sort of to cut to the chase, 2 years later, I won the Republican primary to represent the 18th Congressional District of Texas. I was now thick in the thick in electoral politics, and faced a very well-known African-American Democrat incumbent. It was an interesting race because I'm Jewish and I'm conservative. And, you know, normally that is not something you find. A race like this is not, you know, is not very typical. At least it wasn't back in 1992. Needless to say, campaign contributions were not rolling in to support us. So we had to default to what used to be called simple retail politics. For those of you of a certain age will know, before the internet, candidates used to go door to door, knocking on doors and handing out campaign literature. And that's exactly what my wife and I and all of our volunteers did. I would be on one side of a garden variety Houston street, knocking on doors. People would still answer doors back then, by the way. And my wife would be on the other side, and I would go up to a household that I knew was now in this newly configured 18th congressional district right after redistricting, and the homeowner would have a sign for a different congressional race. And this just didn't happen once or twice. There were dozens, perhaps hundreds of yard signs promoting candidates that weren't the candidate of the homeowner. And I would have to explain that, you know, Congressman Bill Archer is no longer your congressman. Your new congressman is Congressman Craig Washington, and I'm the guy that's running against him. And the reason we had to do this was that block by block, the legislature of the state of Texas had, using what was now in 1992, fairly advanced computer mapping systems, overlapped with census data, they identified almost house by house the race and ethnicity of each voter, and then harvested that voter or that household, or really that census block, into racially homogeneous voting districts. So that if on one side of kind of this garden variety street, there were three or four African American families, or maybe a small apartment complex with three or four African American families, that side of the street would go into one congressional district. Across the street, if there were two or three Hispanic families, or maybe a similar apartment complex with Hispanics, that would now go into a new Hispanic district. And the same thing with, you know, white families. So multiracial, multi-ethnic neighborhoods were split apart block by block to create these sprawling bug splat districts that would go from, you know, 80 miles. If you haven't been to Houston, then just imagine Los Angeles a little smaller. A district would spread out in one direction for 40, 50 miles, another direction, 2 or 3 miles, another direction, so that when you looked at the silhouette of the district that I was running to represent, you really couldn't tell. If someone asked you a question, you couldn't, and said, I live in the Stonington neighborhood of Central Texas, you simply couldn't tell that person what congressional district he or she was drawn into. Now, this is an old story. Racial gerrymandering and gerrymandering in general has been around, but because of these sort of technological improvements, the state of Texas, along with a lot of other states, North Carolina, Virginia, South Carolina, Florida, they went through the same process and created these Rorschach-like districts. So you kind of probably know what happened. I didn't serve in Congress. I lost the election. I ran 10 points ahead of George Herbert Walker Bush, and that was somewhat gratifying in that the following election cycle, my opponent was challenged in the Democrat primary and lost. So, this house by house disintegration of neighborhoods that used to be kept together for the purposes of electing representatives, that bothered me. Lots of things bother me. I guess about 5 or 6 months after the election, I read about a lawsuit that had been filed in North Carolina that had challenged a similar district that was drawn to connect African-American neighborhoods, and part of the district included just one highway, one interstate, Interstate 85, I believe, that connected the African-American neighborhoods in Charlotte with the African-American neighborhoods, I don't know, 85 miles away, using a highway just to connect those two districts. So I thought, well, if they can file a lawsuit in North Carolina, I'll file a lawsuit in Texas. Now, I had, knock wood, I had never been sued before in my life. I had never sued anyone. So here I was, you know, in a position of, in the investment business, needing to hire a legal team to challenge the state of Texas's redistricting policy. Excuse me. I reached into my own pocket, took out about $8,000 a month, found a real estate lawyer in Monroe, Louisiana, who had some experience at this. Now, the reason I had to go to Monroe, Louisiana is because no lawyer at any large law firm in the state of Texas, or even small law firm in the state of Texas, thought that I had a chance of winning. Or, frankly, even the folks in North Carolina had a chance of winning. But I found one guy. I pulled together some friends. We recruited sort of this ragtag team of pro bono lawyers, and we sued the state of Texas, arguing that the Texas Congressional Redistricting Plan was an unconstitutional gerrymander under the 14th Amendment of the United States. We drew a three-judge panel. We had a one-week trial. We had our three or four lawyers at our table. The United States intervened and had like DOJ lawyers. There must have been 50 lawyers on the other side. And lo and behold, about 5 months after the trial, we won. The three-judge panel in the state of Texas declared that the Texas Congressional Redistricting Plan, as it was enacted for the 1992 election, was unconstitutional. That was a wonderful victory. But then something unusual happened that no one anticipated, and that was that the state of Texas appealed to the United States Supreme Court in order to defend their district. And lo and behold, the Supreme Court took it up. So now I have gone from an amateur congressional candidate and an amateur plaintiff to now trying to put together a professional team to argue this case at the Supreme Court, which we did. We made arguments, I guess about 8 months after the court took it up. And a few months after that, lo and behold, we won that case, styled Bush versus Vera, in a 5-4 opinion authored by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. During the course of all of this, my phone started to ring from other people around the country who were in similar situations, people who had learned about the case, obviously, through the Supreme Court. And I asked one of my expert witnesses to compile a list for me of the most racially gerrymandered congressional districts in the country, down to the least racially gerrymandered districts in the country. And I took this winning legal team that now had finally gotten paid from the state of Texas. That's part of the beauty of suing under certain provisions of the Voting Rights Act. And we took this show on the road. I recruited plaintiffs in New York, Virginia, South Carolina, Louisiana, and Florida, and we just started suing. And lo and behold, over the course of about 4 years, we struck down the congressional redistricting plans of all of those states. and here's what happened. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Here's what everyone gained from that. Although the states were compelled to redraw their congressional districts, and they did, and I am not going to tell you that these districts were perfect squares and circles, these busted apart neighborhoods, for the most part, were put back together so that multiracial, multi-ethnic neighborhoods, pardon me, for the most part now, have this commonality. They have a congressperson. And it doesn't matter whether you're white, black, or Hispanic in these neighborhoods any longer. You can come together as Americans and as community members to influence that representative. And that happened, in all of those states. So I thought that was a great beginning to all of this. The day that I won my first lawsuit at the Supreme Court, my business partners at the investment bank I was working at identified that day as the day that my interest in the investment business collapsed and the day that I decided that I was going to become a part-time amateur litigator. And that is indeed what has happened over the last 20 years. My phone continued to ring from parents whose children had been denied admission to a magnet school program in Florida or Texas or Louisiana. Oh, thank you. I needed that. That's good. And I started to put together legal teams that would go out and represent parents and represent individuals challenging race-based policies, whether it pertained to educational issues, additional voting issues, contracting issues, or employment issues. Since that initial case, I have had three cases argued at the Supreme Court. One, a case out of Texas in which we challenged one of the provisions of the Voting Rights Act called Northwest Austin Municipal Utility District Number 1 versus Holder, better known as NMUDNO. NMUDNO was argued at the Supreme Court in 2008, and we won that case, an opinion authored by Chief Justice Roberts. That gave us a win, but it didn't really give us much of a win. It alerted Congress that the provision of the Voting Rights Act that we challenged, and Manning, I think, encapsulated it well, while in 1965, it was important for the Deep South to be put under federal supervision because of the invidious disenfranchisement of African Americans there. By 2006, these provisions had morphed into something very different than what they were used for in 1965. Now they became the very gerrymandering tool that allowed and encouraged states like Texas and New York and Virginia to create these bug splat districts. So we won NMUDNO, but we didn't win much. During the course of litigating NMUDNO, I started reaching out to other jurisdictions and found Shelby County, Alabama. They were a perfect jurisdiction to sort of put the second chop on the log. We won some important legal doctrines with the first case, but I knew it would take a second one. And that case was filed in late 2010. An opinion in that case came down in June of 2013, which basically struck down these provisions. So this provision of the Voting Rights Act that was used in very mischievous ways to separate us by race into different voting districts, that has now come to an end, and my opponents will never forgive me for that. I want to just sort of briefly talk about college admissions, because this affects all of us, because we all have children and grandchildren and nieces and nephews. In 2003, when the Supreme Court allowed the use of racial classifications in two cases from the state of Michigan, I know Manny was involved in writing amicus briefs with that. Those cases were grave disappointments for those of us who believe that your race and ethnicity should not be something that's used to either help you gain admission to college or harm you in your admissions prospects. The Supreme Court allowed, I think, what they described as the delicate use of race in college admissions. The day that opinion came out, the University of Texas held a news conference and announced that that the University of Texas, who had been forbidden from using race and ethnicity in their admissions process, was now going to add race-based affirmative action on top of what everyone recognized was a successful race-neutral means of achieving diversity at UT. That successful race-neutral means was a statute passed during the Bush administration that allowed any student at any high school in Texas who graduated in the top 10% of his or her class to attend any school in the state. And a year or two after that statute became law, the number of racial minorities at the University of Texas exceeded the number of racial minorities that were admitted with affirmative action. So let me make sure you understand this. Texas was precluded from using race and ethnicity for about 7 or 8 years. During this period of time, more minorities were in attendance at UT than before. Their grades were better. Their graduation rates were higher. Yet, the day the Michigan cases came down, the University of Texas decided, wait a minute, we've got the best of all worlds now. We're going to add race-based affirmative action to this. That was another aha moment to me. I knew that I thought was a way for us to get this issue once again before the court, and I started looking for a plaintiff to challenge UT's admissions policies. It took me about 3 years. I found two young women who agreed to sue UT. We sued UT in 2008. Lo and behold, we lost at the district court. We lost at the appellate court, appealed to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court took that case. And we won that case in a 7-1 opinion. Justice Kagan was recused from that. We even picked up Justice Breyer, and brace yourselves, Justice Sotomayor agreed with us. We lost Justice Ginsburg. Now, as you can imagine, what we won with Clarence Thomas and Sonia Sotomayor agreeing on a legal point was not. We didn't win a big buffet. We won like a little nosh. It was like a little half of a sushi roll. But it was an important sushi roll. It was an important concept. And the concept that the Supreme Court came down with in that round of this litigation was that in order for a university to use race and ethnicity in its admissions policies, it must first, and they use the word before turning to racial classifications and preferences, a university must make an attempt to find a race-neutral means to achieve the diversity that they seek. Okay, what does that mean? Well, it means that the University of Texas had this race-neutral means that was very effective. Instead of just striking down UT's plan, apparently there was some horse trading among the justices, and that's why I think we ended up with 7 agreeing to this new higher standard. They remanded the case back to the Fifth Circuit, where we made additional arguments, where we lost again, and now that case, once again, is heading back to the Supreme Court. I decided that while we didn't argue in Fisher 1, nor will we argue in Fisher 2, that the time has come for the Supreme Court to completely end racial classifications and preferences, I started laying the groundwork for a new round of litigation. And to that end, myself and a legal team and all of my pals that get these midnight phone calls from me with crazy ideas, we identified 3 schools. We identified Harvard University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and we identified the University of Wisconsin at Madison. So I needed 3 kids who were rejected from those 3 schools so I could have 3 lawsuits. I did this. You just can't start cold calling for kids. although I've tried that before. So I launched three websites, harvardnotfair.org, uncnotfair.org, and uwnotfair.org. And because by this time, you know, having had four cases at the Supreme Court, the launch of these websites got some notoriety, and the launch was covered by the Times and the New York Times and other newspapers. And over a two-week period, I got probably about 300 kids signed up on these websites. And lo and behold, after flying out to California a few times, going to North Carolina a few times, but unfortunately not going to Wisconsin, I found a group of kids who had been denied admission to Harvard, and a group of kids who had been, small group of kids who had been denied admission to UNC. And we filed a lawsuit challenging both schools on November the 17th. The Harvard lawsuit, of course, is the one that has the highest profile because our plaintiffs at Harvard are Asian. And we argue that Harvard has a hard, strict, intractable quota on Asians today, much like they had a hard, strict quota on Jewish students in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. That lawsuit is underway. Our first status conference with Harvard will take place next month in Boston. Harvard, as you can imagine, has really lawyered up. They just didn't go to a really sharp litigation team. Instead, they went straight to President Bill Clinton's former Solicitor General Seth Waxman, who has argued probably about 50 cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, and his Supreme Court litigation team. So I think the speculation is that that regardless of what happens in the lower courts, one of these two cases, and I'm hopeful to bring a third. Anybody from Wisconsin know anything? that one of these cases will eventually get to the Supreme Court, and Harvard specifically wanted to have their Supreme Court advocates sort of, at square one, if that is the eventuality. So I'm going to encourage you to follow these lawsuits. I make periodic postings to our website, projectonfairrepresentation.org. You can follow this. I assume that if Fisher 2 is taken up by the Supreme Court in early May, then all of this just becomes this kind of bubbling bouillabaisse of affirmative action. And it's my hope that really between the Fisher case and some of these new cases, we will finally sort of achieve what, the great founders and visionaries of the civil rights movement taught us. And that is your race and your ethnicity really shouldn't count for anything, whether it's in college admissions or jobs.